What I would sum it up as, though, is look, the level of people who in Iowa said that they would see a convicted Trump as unfit is an encouraging sign for Biden. The reality is that we're likely to have a very, very close November election. And when you get down to it, on both sides, it's going to be an issue of mobilization. And I think Trump will have perhaps some trouble mobilizing the whole of his Republican and conservative base. But Biden also will have trouble in that regard. And so we've got a long, complicated, and frankly, pretty frustrating race ahead of us.
And we're going to have to leave it there. And Nikki Haley is pouring money into new ads where she refers to the Trump-Biden nightmare. John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent, speaking to us from Wisconsin, just back from Iowa. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, February 17th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a special live remote broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream. Keep Alive the Dream is an annual celebration of the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This year's event includes guest speakers and musical performances from the MLK All-Star Band, Eli Hardy, and more. Again, that's a special live broadcast of Keep Alive the Dream, Saturday, February 17th, from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held. KBOO.
And just for fun, we'll say it one more time. This is KBOO Portland. It's a little after 8 on a Tuesday morning. It's time for Too Much Information with your hosts, Tracy Simmons and Abe Proctor. Stay tuned.
Hey, good morning, good morning, good morning, and welcome to Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. My name is Abe Proctor. Joining me, as she does every week, Tracy Simmons. Good morning, Tracy.
Oh, good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners.
It is cold. I'm sure that's not a news. Yes, freezing cold. I hope that you are safe. I hope that you have taken steps to batten down the hatches wherever it is that you are living. Because it has been nasty for the past several days out there, and it's going to get nastier still over the course of the day. So please take good care if you need to be out and about today. Thank you for tuning in. If you would like to join the conversation, the number to call 503-231-8187. Tracy, we suddenly had an official electoral event happen yesterday.
Yes, the Iowa caucuses happened yesterday. And, you know, I think we've kind of had a sense of what would happen there. The final result, Trump got 51% of the vote. Ron DeSantis with 21.2%. Nikki Haley right behind with 19.1%. And Vivek at 7.7% has now decided to drop out of the race. But, you know, I think, you know, today we're going to have a conversation about Iowa in general, like, why are we still doing this? how do we feel about, you know, 51% of Iowan Republicans choosing the former guy? What does that mean for him if, you know, we look at it on the flip side, 49% said no thank you. They held their nose and said no thank you and picked another person. What does that mean for the larger implications of the 2024 race? And then also, like, who is Nikki Haley? I think we've talked about, you know, Ron, ugh, that guy. You know, Nikki Haley is you know, pushing forward, and she's, I think for some people, a lot more palatable than Ron DeSantis or Trump. She's a woman, so, you know, it sounds kind of edgy for Republicans to nominate a woman president. Ooh. But yeah, we want to talk about her and make y'all a little more familiar with who Nikki Haley really is.
All right. As I mentioned, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I think at first blush, Tracy, the results of this caucus tell us a few things we already know or knew. And also a couple of things that may or may not come into play as the former guy's legal troubles continue to mount between now and election day. 51% of the vote. He won by the largest margin I heard earlier today of any candidate in the history of the Iowa caucuses. Resounding victory out in front of his nearest competitor by more than 30 percentage points. So in that respect, yes, about what we expected. Trump is the presumptive nominee in this race. He clobbered his opponents. Whatever it is he's selling, the GOP electorate is buying it. But also, about 50% of voters decided they didn't want this guy. Almost half of the people who bothered to show up in Iowa yesterday, and we should note that the conditions were incredibly poor for turnout, incredibly cold and snowy, half of those people decided they didn't like him. So I don't know. I can't say we have enough tea leaves here to read anything with any degree of accuracy, but it seems to me that as we move through this campaign, and for example, if Trump is convicted on one of the many the many charges on which of which he has been accused, we might see that percentage of the Republican electorate who don't want this guy to grow. I don't know. We shall see. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all remains to be seen. I don't think for hardcore Trump supporters they give a care about his, you know, criminal, you know, dalliances, his 91 indictments, his multiple other civil lawsuits that are pending. I don't think they care too much about that. But I think they might, you know, just really want a fresh start. And they know that, you know, Trump got also clobbered by Biden in 2020. And so they're looking for maybe the next best thing. I think they love Ron DeSantis for the sanitized and snarky way his racism is performed. And he's been quite successful in Florida. Right. So, I mean, if you are a Republican and you are very much, you know, on board with kind of the white supremacist arm of the Republican Party, right, that's very enticing. Right. All of the, you know, anti-DEI efforts, the Stop Woke, all of that could be a really shiny thing for you if that's what you're into. And so he's showing up in this way. And, you know, he's also wearing similar, you know, ill-fitting suits and that, you know, crud-eating grin. I'm just trying to get past FCC rules here. But, you know, he just has that smarmy kind of look. People love it. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know how this will turn out. I think for folks who at some point have to choose between either the former guy or Ron DeSantis or the former guy or Nikki Haley, right, there's the tea leaves are not quite clearly able to be read. You're right.
That's an interesting take, that DeSantis' flavor of racism is just more palatable to some voters than Trump's racism. Because
well,
let's face it.
Just get out there and say things like, you know, they're bringing drugs and they might be good people, but, you know, they're actually rapists and da da da. Like, he doesn't do that. It doesn't sound like that when he says the racist stuff that he says. He says stuff like, we've got to protect our borders. You know, we've got to think about the integrity of our culture. We've got to stop wokeism, right? Like, he's made some really cute statements that are, on the face of it, racist as heck. But, you know, for people who oftentimes sit in that space of denialism around racism, right, it's a lot more easy to roll off the tongue and not sound like a racist.
Sometimes you want a nice slab of racism grilled medium rare, and sometimes you want a nice racism salad, you know?
I'm just saying, right? The diet racism works for a lot of folks.
503-231-8187. So Iowa, let's talk about Iowa for a second, Tracy. It has historically been the first of the nominating contests, and it adheres to a format that has gone out of style in almost every other state, and that is the caucus, where people actually get together in a room and they hash these things out, and in some cases even will do an old-fashioned, okay, everybody in favor of this candidate, stand over there. Everybody in favor of this candidate, stand over there. It's a system that has its detractors and its adherents. But above all, I think I'm a critic of the Iowa caucus, and I'm a critic of them going first, because as a state, Iowa is so incredibly unrepresentative of the rest of the United States. And the same with New Hampshire, which is typically right on the heels of the Iowa caucus. Those two states, the first two electoral contests, have populations that really in no way are an accurate cross-section of the rest of the country.
Yeah,
so I think they tend to give us an inaccurate feel of people's preference. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is what we have from the most recent census. Iowa is 87.93% white. Two or more races, 3.89%. Black or African American, 3.74%. Asian, 2.49%. And every other demographic of racial category is not statistically valid. That's how white Iowa is.
Yeah.
It's also a smaller state. You know, it's one of the probably worst Midwestern states. Sorry for anyone on listening right now who's from Iowa. Cornfields everywhere, not much else. There are 3.2 million people that live in Iowa. Of those 3.2 million, 2.1 million are registered to vote. And of those registered voters, 901 are registered Republicans. There's an interesting, pretty large number of people who are unaffiliated, 715,000 people unaffiliated, and a much smaller number of Democrats who are registered at 631,000 plus. So, you know, it's a red state. There's a lot of those people who say they're undecided, which I don't actually believe exist. right, there's people who are like, well, I can't be in the caucus if I don't say I'm a Republican, or however that works out, right? There are people who say they're unaffiliated for other reasons, and so there's a large number of those folks. Out of all those people, 115,000 people voted last night, which is one of the lowest turnouts ever for an Iowa caucus. Interesting.
I can't believe the shade you just heaped on Iowa, Tracy. Cornfields and not much else?
I mean, have you been?
There's soybeans. There are soybean fields, too. Let's be fair.
I'm so free.
503-231-8187. So it sounds like we're in agreement that the current primary and caucus system is not a good way to conduct an election in a country the size of the United States, or a country of any size, really, if we're being honest about it. And the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire are so unrepresentative of the rest of the country, I think suggests that it's time to overhaul the system. And there has been much more conversation in recent election cycles on this front than I can recall in years gone past. Personally, I would like to see one nationwide primary day. Let's make it like, let's say, 2 months before the general election. You have 1 month prior to that to run your primary campaign. The whole election season is 3 months long. We have all the primaries on one day. We know right away who the party nominees are going to be. And you spend the next 2 months campaigning for president, and then we're done. What do you think?
I mean, it makes more sense. I think what happens is you have these very white states that go first, and they sway the public opinion about who can win. Here we go, right? It's such this interesting falling of dominoes that happens after that. So I see, like, if we were to just have all on, you know, Super Tuesday kind of thing where everybody has their primary, it would be different. It would be different because the public opinion wouldn't be swayed. I mean, potentially it could be because of time zones, but I don't think that would make as big of a difference as, you know, now for the next month, you know, people are going to be, oh, Trump is the winner in Iowa. Like, you know, it does absolutely have an impact on public opinion and polling, all of that, right?
Right. I'm sure people recall that in 2016 and again in, 2000 and, when did Bernie run for president the first time? Was it 2016? In 2016, Bernie came out of the gate with very strong showings in Iowa and again in New Hampshire, and there was a lot of talk about he might be able to continue that role all the way through the Democratic nomination. But of course, the air was let out of that balloon really as soon as people of color voted in significant numbers, which was the South Carolina primary. So, you know, the narratives that build out of these early contests and the perception of the momentum of the race, I think really can't be taken seriously. And what are we doing? What are we doing in a modern representative democracy like ours with 330 million people in it? What are we doing fooling around like this with a system that's so archaic and gives us such a poor impression of what's actually going on? If you haven't noticed, Tracy, I'm in favor of scrapping this in favor of something better. That's where I'm at.
I think that's our stick. I'm in favor of scrapping the whole thing, but, you know, we know we can't really do all of that because the system is designed to maintain the status quo. And so the system itself replicates outcomes all the time because it's designed that way. And if we want it to have a different outcome, we'd have to redesign the system. But the system itself doesn't have a mechanism for redesigning the system. I mean, it's just the craziest thing. Make it make sense.
Sorry, I can't help you. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Santiago. Good morning.
Good morning. I think when it comes to Nikki Haley, she's no different in a lot of ways than Vivek Ramaswamy, Andrew Yang, Dinesh D'Souza, particularly, in that, like, she is simply, like, she's playing into the Asian model minority and proximity to whiteness in order to be able to bolster her campaign. If we remember, it was the Republicans who weaponized Asian Americans in order to end affirmative action. So you see that a lot of Asian folks, particularly South Asian, they just kind of graft themselves on through whatever Stockholm syndrome they're going through. They latch themselves on to the most reactionary of American politics in this way because a lot of them have generational wealth. Now, that's not to say all of them. Obviously, we have some other folks who are, you know, Middle Eastern descent, which is, you know, like, you know, Rashida Tlaib. But at the same time, if they're still attaching themselves to it, but they're not, but it's not the most outwardly racist or fascist portion of the system. But I mean, it's no different than black or brown folks like Clarence Thomas or Kamala Harris, where they latch themselves on. They promote this idea of black excellence, or like Sotomayor, like Latino excellence, where they simply are saying that the system worked for me. As long as you can kowtow to the system and not be proud of yourself in ways that upset the current mode of thinking, then you're going to be able to make it. And it's really sad because, I mean, essentially what we're arguing here is we're arguing personalities when we got to be looking at policies. And even if you don't necessarily agree at the face level that Kamala Harris and Nikki Haley have something in common, it's the sense that, like, poor folks don't really see the difference, and particularly poor folks abroad, because we see that there's no difference in how America supports Israel depending on whether we have a Republican or a Democrat in office, because they both cape for the same system. And I think it's really important to remember here that Martin Luther King, it was just his day yesterday, and he pointed out that the reason why he was against capitalism is because it was the white supremacist arm of the of the American, the white supremacist arm of the American capitalist system. That's how capitalism works. It's the white supremacist economic arm. So if we're going to pull away from these type of like weird like caping identity politics that people are engaged in, then we need to pull away from the system that creates that division in the first place. I mean, even Nikki Haley, for as much as I don't like her, she published something in Sky News Australia, and it says basically saying that, you know, 70% of Americans don't want another Trump Biden debate, which is true. But then she takes that and says, "Oh well, we need a more conservative." But it's like, no, that's not it. But at least she is speaking to the fact that Americans are fed up. Most of the Democrats can't even say that, even if it's just paying lip service to be able to gin up any sort of support. You don't see anybody out there saying we don't want another Biden presidency that has any. That's on any sort. I mean, I don't think there's anybody even running against Biden at this point. So there's nobody vocalizing that we need somebody different than Biden. So, yeah, I mean, but I mean, those are just the points that, you know, we need to stop pretending that like she's like this new person. She's a new face on an old stenciling. You know what I mean?
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, thank you for the call. As always, Santiago, appreciate your perspective.
I agree with much of what was said. You know, I think for me, Nikki Haley is the picture of what I refer to, or my discipline refers to, as multiracial whiteness. She is a daughter of immigrants, Indian immigrants. She changed her name. Her name is Nimrata. She changed her name, Nikki, to be more palatable to white folks and more acceptable because, of course, you know, the name that was given to her at her birth does not sound Caucasian enough. There are other realities. Her father worked at a HBCU in South Carolina, and she was raised, amongst, kind of the high-class folks who infiltrated black spaces but did not actually engage with black community. And so that's her reality. South Carolina has a long history of racism. It still kind of resonates today. But, you know, I'm just guessing while she was growing up, there was still, de facto segregation. And she existed in that kind of environment. And as a person of color, right, you have some choices. You have the choice to kind of align yourself with whiteness in a way that allows you to be accepted in those places, but that oftentimes means you have to, really assert yourself as not one of those other people. And I think that's part of her socialization. That's how she shows up. Once again, she chose a name that is acceptable, palatable. She rarely talks about her actual existence as a woman of color. I don't think that is an identity that she feels comfortable really sharing with folks. There are people who, I mean, I recently told them, like, oh, she's Indian. And they're like, what? Like half, like no, she's Indian. Both of her parents are from India, via Canada to South Carolina. Like that's her lived experience. But I think there's a way for some people of color to really distance themselves from that immigrant status, that status of having a different culture. And in America, there is a benefit to doing so for people of color, because once you align yourself with whiteness, to some degree, you get to benefit from it. And the whole project of whiteness itself is to get folks to align to a structure and a culture that, you know, produces, benefits for some and burdens for others. And so if you can be on the benefit side and not have to experience the burdens, well, then why wouldn't you, right? Whole time, right, there's people, I'm sure, of her same background that are experiencing all kinds of discrimination and harm that she would probably never, ever, do anything policy-wise or in the sphere of having any kind of power or control to alleviate that pain, because, of course, part of that denialism of your own culture and background is to pretend like the other folks who are suffering don't exist.
What is your assessment of her intelligence and her experience and her acumen? Like all of this other stuff aside, you know, does she have the juice to be president of the United States, do you think?
I don't know if anyone has the quote-unquote juice to be the president. I'm not going to, you know, say that she's not quote-unquote qualified, because that would be me making an assumption and likely with bias of her and her gender. And I don't know that anyone's ever been prepared to be president. And right now, the way the world is working, it's very uncertain, right? We've got Vladimir Putin basically pulling Hitler, trying to take up more, you know, land for his country. He's, you know, basically engaging in a potential possible war with NATO and NATO allies. We've got what's happening in Gaza and with Israel. It's a real crummy time to become president, actually. And so... I mean, if I had to, you know, say I trust a woman, I do. Her, not so much.
That's true. And recent history has shown us that you really don't have to be qualified at all to be president of the United States.
Basically. I don't even know what qualified is. It's a job that is, you know, undoable, unmanageable, with a lot of people who suck at doing their jobs to support you doing your job. I mean, my goodness. Yeah.
I mean, if your resume had, say, you know, 5 years as host of a middling reality television show. And for people, that's enough. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Let's go to Corey. Good morning, Corey.
Hey, good morning, you guys. I want to piggyback on what Santiago was saying and some of what Tracy was saying. I work in academics, and I am African-American male, and so I get the privilege of being quote-unquote one of the good ones. And I guess where I see this a lot, the sort of racial stratification between, you know, Black people, Indian people, Asian people, is in academics, where, you know, I'll be used as an example, you know, like Abe was saying, you know, well, Corey, you know, you made it. You know, why can't everybody else? I'm like, we're not looking at the structure. We're not looking at the systems or how I made it, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, that proximity to whiteness, it's very dangerous, because ultimately it all ties into white supremacy and also anti-Blackness. And the reason I say anti-Blackness is because every other group partakes in this. And what I mean by that, I've worked with professors from Africa and Jamaica, and even they've been like, well, yeah, they will let you know that I am from quote unquote Nigeria, but I'm not African American. So let's you know, you don't ever consider me African American. I'm not one of those people. And it's like, well, you know, but interesting fact, recently someone needed some help, and so they came to the African American. I'm like, well, hold up, are you sure you want my help? I don't know if I can help you. Like, I'm African American. I'm not fully African. So, but then you also see it. You know, I noticed that my grandmother has. You know, indigenous Native American blood, and you would see it there with the blood quantum, where especially with the Muscogee Nation, how even they didn't want to accept anybody that had Black blood, but if you had white blood, okay, we're going to accept you, and they went out of their way to do it. And I think it's very interesting. I think it's a discussion we need to have, especially in the context of Nikki Haley or Bobby Jindal, who was also, his name was Paisley Jindal, and you see these different ways to where different races, and especially different races who are, and not to be xenophobic, but, you know, immigrants or first, or, you know, people who immigrate or First Nation immigrant, where to be American, part of that is to hate African American, because, like, yeah, I want that proximity to whiteness. And like I said, it's very specific, that language of African American versus someone who is from Africa or Jamaica. I saw it, and even take it out of the States, I saw it, you know, in Vancouver, BC, the most, where, oh, you know, we'll let you in the circle, even though you're not from the islands, you're not, you know, you're African American. It's almost like, well, how did you get through, you know, how did you get through the hood? I'm like, I grew up in Sugar Land, Texas, my guy. It's, you know, it's just these assumptions that you must have grown up, you know, smoking crack, or how'd you do it? Like, well, let me tell you. So, you know, these stereotypes, they're very, you know, hurtful as well, but I think it's a discussion that needs to be had, just the different ways that we are used to, like, yeah, we'll use one group, like with the affirmative action, to sort of you know, hurt another group, but primarily that group that y'all were hurting. And my final piece of this, and this is why you need critical race theory in all the schools. If you had critical race theory in all the schools, then we could actually discuss these topics instead of people being afraid of it. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, thank you for the excellent call, as always. 503-231-8187. What are your thoughts, Tracy, on that phone call?
Well, you know, I think we've been, in the Black community, been talking about immigrants who actually have Black skin, to Corey's point, who distance themselves from Black culture, because that's part of the indoctrination of immigrant people. Like, it's sold worldwide. So before they even come here, they're getting an image of who Black people are, you know, all of the negative parts of you know, Black culture as stereotyped through media, publications. I mean, it's basically farmed out internationally from the United States. And so there's this understanding of that when they get here. There's more indoctrination when they get here. And so this is just, unfortunately, a fact of being in American culture, that the strata, as it's been created, puts Black people as a permanent underclass. So I absolutely recognize that. I think there's been long conversations about how Africans and Black people exist and coexist in American culture and what work we have to do. But I think, too, the point of, you know, Nikki Haley and her kind of ascendancy into the space, remember, like, we didn't know her name until she became a Trump nominee and ultimately a Trump cabinet member, right? Like right. This is not a person that I would trust to watch my cats on the weekend if I was going out of town, right? So, but I just, I feel like if we're going to talk about qualified, right, what does that even mean anymore? What does it mean for us to be thinking about who is qualified? What are the qualifications of a person who would have this kind of unlimited power? And we've seen a person that, you know, most of us thought was kind of innocuous, somebody's uncle, kind of creepy, potentially not very bright, not very sharp, in Biden. And he's been doing things like, you know, surpassing Congress to continue funneling basically a genocide, right? If we're going to be really honest, like, so I just feel like I don't even know anymore, but not her.
Right. Right. But she did helpfully dodge a question on what the Civil War was really about. That was an interesting episode. Yeah. You mentioned she was part of Trump's cabinet. And I think that's important to bring up in the context of evaluating her as a politician. She was the our United States ambassador to the United Nations. Where she did not cover herself in glory during that post. She gave diplomatic cover to Israel when this was, of course, before the outbreak of the recent hostilities there, when they used lethal force over protesters in Gaza. She also presided infamously over the United States' withdrawal from the UN Human Rights Council, which admittedly is a problematic body, but I think on balance does more good than harm in the world. But that was, I think, in the minds of many observers, a big black eye for the United States internationally. If there is such a body as the UN Human Rights Council, then the United States ought to be on it. And we are, of course, back on that council again, but that's what happened under President Trump in his first term, and probably an indicator of the sort of thing that might happen again. 503-231-8187. So, sounds like you're not impressed with Nikki Haley, Tracy.
I mean, no. I mean, I guess I'm not. And I do question the ability for anyone to lead this country who can, with a straight face, tell us that the Civil War was not about slavery. That can, with a straight face, deny that racism is kind of the center and prevailing value of the United States. I mean, I don't trust anybody who cannot be really honest about history. And I mean, that's another reason why Ron DeSantis could never be my president, because there's, you know, there's this effort to kind of roll back and retell and build a new narrative around DEI and what that means. All of that is very harmful to our country. And so, no, I wouldn't trust anybody with those kinds of ideologies or that level of being able to deny reality, to look me in the face and tell me the truth about, you know, what is being, what's happening at the policymaking table. Absolutely not. Sorry.
503-231-8187. Mitch, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for taking the call. I really want to follow up on your previous caller, because without saying it, what I think he was trying to express from his experience being black progressive, but finding that the identity politics was raising the dynamic of caste in American life, so that Nikki Haley maybe can, you know, in the immigrant experience, her family coming from India, get whitewashed through Canada and sort of, you know, given the benefits of the lightness of her skin and the Anglification of her first name, pass as white. The dynamics of caste are interesting because it's not just a right-wing phenomenon. I understand why nobody wants to talk about the fact that the Democrats do have some opposition from the progressive side, and it's just from someone who left the Democratic Party, and that would, of course, be Cornel West, who doesn't even get named as a realistic candidate by progressive white or black movements in the United States. He's downplayed completely, and I understand part of the dynamics there is nobody wants someone splitting the Democratic vote and letting Trump get back in. But nevertheless, the fact that there's what identity politics has done is, as long as we're not talking about policies, the best person as any announced candidate would clearly be Cornel West, just based on policies.
What are policy efforts or initiatives that you think he would be focused on, or that he has espoused he'd be focused on?
I would recommend that people go online and look at the talk he gave only a few days ago, and it's on C-SPAN. And he goes point by point through the economics of how the percentages of people who are in the smaller but richer uber wealthy class got there, and how the rest of us have slipped into a poverty that we keep getting told over the mass media is not poverty, because the mass media only represents Wall Street. There's not one labor program or one labor perspective that has ever had a regular slot in American commercial or public broadcasting. There's just never been a program representing working people. And Cornel West is the only person that talks about that.
So how would you remedy this situation, Mitch? It sounds like you acknowledge that Mr. West, although his campaign platform is appealing to you, stands little chance of actually winning the presidency or gaining a major party nomination. So what is it you're pushing for here that you would like to see?
Yeah, I think that first of all, you made the point rhetorically that we're not talking policies, we're talking personalities and identities. So I appreciate that. But you're really not substituting policies in your own discussion. And nobody is on the air. And I'm saying that if they did, Cornel West would suddenly become a very realistic candidate, because he actually supported Barack Obama at the beginning, and then Cornel West was turned on by the black community, the wealthy part of the black community, and here caste comes into it again, because he began criticizing Obama's economic policies and Biden's economic policies and the whole corporate Democrat. And that's what caused Cornel West to leave the Democratic Party. And his first run as president was being backed by the Greens, but he realized there's baggage with the Greens too, and so he is going independent. And the only reason he's not a realistic candidate, I think, aside from where caste and color race comes in, is the fact that we can't talk about policies, because if we talked about policies, he's the only person that is addressing what the mass of impoverished America is experiencing while Wall Street is triumphing and every broadcast outlet is touting the fact that we've dodged a major recession and we should be celebrating. When most of us can't make the rent.
I see your point. And listen, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Certainly. Tracy, here's my take on this, and let me know if you agree, please. Mr. West's platform, I'm looking at it right now, I think it's one that virtually every progressive can get behind. Doing away with poverty, doing away with homelessness, establishing a federal public banking institution to fund public infrastructure and green reconstruction. He's got a really inspiring section on worker justice, environmental justice, and all of these things. Where I disagree with Mitch is that I think even if we were operating in a media environment where policy considerations like this constituted a large component of the discourse, I don't know that that would elevate Cornel West into the position of being a viable candidate for nationwide office. Rather, I think that the discussion about the policy items would help push the overall window of discussion farther to the left, which is exactly what happened during Bernie Sanders' two campaigns for president. He didn't win the nomination ultimately, but because of his two campaigns, we are now talking in seriousness about positions that not very long ago were considered off the leftward fringe of the spectrum. So I agree with Mitch that you know the absence of a policy discussion in this campaign is glaring, and that if we were to have something even approaching a regular nominative process on the Democratic side, that we could be having discussions like this, and that would push the overall discourse farther to the left where it needs to be. But I don't think that Cornel West as a candidate is somebody that mainstream America, and by that I mean most white voters, are going to be able to get behind. What do you think?
I mean, I absolutely think there's a reason for that. I won't say it again, but y'all know what I know the reason is. He's a, you know, older man with an afro and a gap, and happens to be black. I think that means a lot. But just the process of even becoming a candidate and a nominee means that people have to donate. And the reality of our system as it currently exists, to people with more money, get more resources to campaign, to go places, to have their message heard in different places. And I don't think that the system right now would allow a person, even with these kind of policy initiatives that absolutely would support a growing investment in a social safety net, you know, minimum wage increases, all of these things that he's wanting. I think they're all great things. But he, as the messenger, will likely never be able to be in the position to move them forward. So, yes, I mean, I think that's true of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, though, at least has a long history of being in government, having a you know, political role, regardless of what you think about his kind of political history. But, yeah, change the conversation. Guess what? Nothing came of healthcare for all. Nothing came of some of those policy initiatives because the system itself rewards the very, very wealthy who have the money to buy their own candidates. Once again, we're talking about our system itself is broken. Maybe not so much Cornel West, although I've had some challenges with things he said in the past. I do not disagree that what he's talking about and what he would like to have happen would radically change the country, But once again, the country is not set up for radical change. It is incrementalism. It is no change at all. It is pointing fingers. To Mitch's point, though, I do want to say this, and I'll stop. People's identities absolutely informs the kinds of policies they make. To deny a person's identity doesn't show up in the way that they do things, the way they think about things, the way that they critically even, you know, consider how things are versus how they could be is ridiculous to me. We talk and harp about identity politics all the time. Your identity has an impact. Your lived experience, all of the things that you know to be true, your faith, your religion, your racial identity, your ethnic identity, they all have a part in how you think about the world, how you see the world, and how you see the world being able to be changed or not. So I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think you could say quite accurately that white voters have always been, have always practiced their own brand of identity politics. The reason we don't talk about it is because it's invisible, and that was presumed because white culture has been the dominant culture, you know, that's the way things work. So really, you only hear about identity politics usually from white politicians and commentators, and it's usually about people whose identity is outside that accepted norm of whiteness and of privilege. So, yes, I think that's spot on. 503-231-8187. Let's go to Joseph. Good morning. Joseph, are you there?
Oh, sorry.
No worries.
Yeah. Hey, I'd like to say hello to all the people up the gorge who are listening to us right now because they're hunkering down. And so is this the Iowa caucus a GOP caucus?
Say again, nope. I'm sorry?
Is this the GOP caucus?
Yes.
Yes.
Why are we all concerned about what the GOP thinks about what their candidate should be? It has very little bearing on the full range of voters in Iowa.
No, I think that's very true. I think the reason we're talking about it is there's an absence of a nominating process on the other side for the other major party. And secondly, because because we're talking about the prospective reelection of a dude who executed a coup attempt not so very long
ago. They can't throw him in jail fast enough. There's no justice. Right. So. But shouldn't we be like looking at the full spectrum of the political scene instead of just focusing on one area and one small? And you know, you know why they do the caucus in January in Iowa?
Why is that?
Because Iowa smells so bad from all the pig farms that it freezes in the winter, and that's the only time it's bearable.
Hmm.
Anyway, have a nice day.
Yeah, you too. 503-231-8187. I have to say I've never heard that particular theory advanced as to why the Iowa caucus is in January, Tracy.
Okay, it's a terrible place, but let me stop. You know, I think, and this is interesting because we were asked a question, why are we having this conversation today? Because we're a topical radio show and we talk about things that just happened. And this just happened yesterday, so that's why we're talking about this. We have already poked holes in, are the Democrats going to have any kind of electoral process that allows us to think about anybody other than Joe Biden? Of course, Cornel West is now identifying as an independent, so we wouldn't even be able to consider him in that conversation. So, you know, I don't know. I don't think we have a real, true democracy at this point. And to continue saying that, to change the narrative about, oh, we're a democracy, we get to choose. Well, we don't really have a choice. Two people is not a choice. It's a binary choice. And, you know, one is not a choice at all. And that's kind of where people who kind of show up on the left are really frustrated. And I'll speak for myself. When I say I'm really frustrated, like what? No choice at all.
Yes, and we can acknowledge that frustration. I think we have many, many times. And I think we've also acknowledged many, many times the need for the United States to move beyond the binary apparatus that we have right now for elections. Now, all of that said, yes, we do need to do those things. But until that happens, this is the system we have. These are the choices, such as they are. And I would say, despite how unpalatable that choice may be, there's a clear better choice in this situation. 503-231-8187. I feel like we're going to get roasted by callers now, Tracy. So, Nikki Haley, let me ask you about something that that Corey brought up in his phone call earlier. He suggested that, in fact, he invoked something called the, he said the word model minority, and that it's something that Nikki Haley and other politicians of Asian descent have been able to use to their advantage. I'm not really clear on that term. Can you enlighten us on that?
Tell me again right now?
Model minority. Tell us more about
model minority. Well, that's just this idea that Asians as a group are, their culture is more aligned with the culture of whiteness. And so they are seen as the minority everyone else should be like. So when we look at data, we're looking at things like income, employment statistics, we're looking at things like grades and college admissions, right? Oftentimes, the Asian category, which is a very large and not well disaggregated category, is oftentimes, when we're just looking at raw data, either on par with white folks or even sometimes exceeding white folks in success categories. The problem with that is that it is based off of stereotypes. It is oftentimes used to promote stereotypes, but also doesn't take into account the different areas and places people are coming from, the different lived experiences people have. So, you know, we know about the destruction of places like Vietnam and Cambodia and other places in Southeast Asia where folks have darker skin. If we begin to disaggregate the Asian category and take into account all of those different demographics within that category, a different picture emerges. A different picture that looks like there's some kind of colorism potentially happening. There's a story and thread through there around immigrant status and being a refugee in another place. But historically, what we've done is kind of uplifted Asian cultures as like the model, like black people should just be more like Asian people, Native American people should just be more like Asian people, right? And so it also, because if you have a culture or a group, once again, a large group that has been through stereotype, through media, through kind of this veneration of a culture, says like, they can do it, why can't you, right? Notwithstanding histories of racial exclusion, histories of genocide for Native American folks, histories of land theft, labor theft, you know, discrimination, right? We could ignore all of that and say, but they're not from here either, right? They're from a different culture. They look different. Why can't you just be like them? That is the model minority myth. And it really helps to perpetuate the stereotypes about Asian folks, and also is harmful for Asians themselves, but also harmful for the system of interrogating whiteness and how it's working in our country.
Wow, thank you for that. The appellation Asian American has always puzzled me because, I mean, it's an enormous place, Asia, right? And so to aggregate everybody who's immigrated from there, whose ancestors immigrated from Asia, I think it's misleading, and I think it doesn't help for careful analysis of demographics or of socioeconomic conditions. So thank you for that. 503-231-8187. 1-800-387-8787. Engineer Sonia weighs in to see why people get to be mediocre and still succeed. Well, yes. Yes, that is part of the problem.
There's a myth of meritocracy.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so after Iowa, Tracy, we have New Hampshire, another, as we mentioned earlier, completely unrepresented state. And as we go on further into the nominating process on the GOP side, because, again, as we mentioned, that's the only nominating process that's happening right now, the GOP side of things is heavily weighted towards a winner-take-all contest. Iowa is sort of an exception in that regard, in that the finishers were able to split the number of delegates coming out of the caucus. Going forward, most of the states on the GOP side are going to be winner-take-all. So I think we're going to see a situation where very rapidly we see Trump as the Republican nominee. That's where we're headed. Yeah, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Big sigh. I mean, yeah.
Big sigh. So here I think are a couple of wild cards that could affect the way that plays out. First of all, as we mentioned here, despite winning by more than 30 percentage points in Iowa, which is a resounding victory for any candidate, roughly half of the Republican electorate decided they wanted somebody besides Donald Trump. I suspect that is the case in many places around the country. Probably not so much in the old Confederacy, but in other states, it's probably that way. So what happens then if the president, the former guy, is convicted of a felony and is running his campaign from behind bars? It's really hard to say. This is why this election cycle is unprecedented in our memory or in anybody else's memory. And it's one of the reasons we're going to be keeping a very close eye on it going forward. What do you think happens if the former guy is convicted, Tracy?
I don't even think we have a system to address that, right? Like, if he's convicted, which also I think there's a bias on the people who will do the convicting, right? Like, ooh, can we do this? He's a nominee, should we? So that also gives him some criminal cover, because I think there's just this conundrum of like, how do we even address this? But I think, you know, when we talk about a system that has set up and been designed to maintain the status quo, and that doesn't have any kind of, there's no clause for a criminally convicted presidential candidate, what do you do about that? I think we're kind of making it up as we go, which is pretty, to me, scary.
Yeah, I think we are kind of making it up as we go, and I think that just throws into starker relief just how fundamentally absurd this whole enterprise is. The Constitution is pretty clear. The 14th Amendment says you can't run for office if you did an insurrection, and we have a guy who did an insurrection. And I also think, while it's very hard to read the minds of people who lived and breathed 250 years ago, that the founders of the nation probably imagined someone running for president who was not in jail. I'm going to go out on a limb there and say that's what they envisioned. They were not envisioning someone campaigning from inside a cell. There it is. We've got one more phone call. Let's see if we can squeeze that in before the end. Van, good morning.
Yeah. I watched the network news last night, and I saw the interviews with the voters who were supporting Trump, and I started thinking to myself, well, maybe he wouldn't be that bad. And when I started realizing what I was thinking, I got scared. I'm scared. You know.
Van?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. We lost you there for a second. Please continue.
Oh, should I start over?
You said you were scared. What was your follow up to that?
What's that? That was it. There was a pause.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. There's a lot that really frightens me about this moment in time politically for us.
And what makes it worse is that Republicans are dropping out and supporting Trump. I mean, you know, it's just like we're accepting this guy as the status quo. And he has, I mean, he brought us closer to anarchy. Ever since the Civil War. I mean, the whole January 6th thing, you know, that can't happen in democracy, right?
One would think. Yeah.
Anyway, that's my comment. Thanks for the show.
Yeah. Hey, thanks very much for the call. Tracy, we're right up at the end. Why don't you take us?
Yeah, we're right at the end. Well, of course, there's some warming shelters in Portland. If you're in the metro area, if you know somebody that needs to get warmed, if you have unsheltered folks in your neighborhood, please check on folks. There are freezing conditions through the night, freezing rain. It's terrible, terrible time to be unsheltered. So if you know somebody, please refer them to services. The buses will be not requesting fares if folks need to get moved to a shelter or a warming space. Please do what you can to take care of yourselves and each other.
And let's leave it there. This has been Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thanks to everybody who called in today. Buckle up. It's going to be interesting the next few months. Please, please stay warm out there and take care of those who are close to you. For Tracy Simmons, my name is Dave Crocker. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back at you next week.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Do you need some quiet mood music? Some soothing sounds?
Well, then never listen to Life During Wartime, because they just play really obnoxious DIY punk from local bands and international acts. Sometimes they have bands play live, and it's all with the yelling and the screaming and the... I don't like my mom and dad or my teachers and all that kind of stuff. That's Life During Wartime, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of An Oregon Story, saving our beaches, farmland, and more. Screening from January 17th through January 31st across multiple venues in Portland and beyond.